Well, good morning to everyone. Thanks, all of you, for coming to CSIS on a frigid morning like this one. Welcome to our series on Cuba. Today, the Cuban Armed Forces, which is a topic of great interest, obviously, and real significance for the days ahead in Cuba. We're extremely fortunate today to have with us a very distinguished panel of three experts on different affairs regarding Cuba. We're going to, the speakers will speak in alphabetical order. We were saying KLM. The first speaker will be Dr. Hal Klepek, former professor of history at the Royal Military College of Canada and currently a senior advisor to the Minister of National Defense in Canada. Dr. Klepek's current area of focus includes the evolution of strategic thought and diplomatic and military history of Latin America and Cuba. He's a renowned expert on the Cuban military, having published several books and having dedicated himself to the study of the Cuban military for some time. Dr. George Lambie is a principal lecturer in the Department of Public Policy at De Montfort University since 1992 in the UK, and is also a founding member and visiting professor of the International Institute for the Study of Cuba at London Metropolitan University. He's been a visiting professor at the University of Havana and has written about the Cuban Revolution in the context of globalization and democracy. And finally, Dr. Frank Mora is professor of national security strategy at the National War College, which he joined in 2004, an expert on civil-military relations in Latin America, Cuban politics, and U.S.-Cuban relations. I think we'll find the speakers will give us an extremely broad and at the same time detailed view of this important topic. Let's start with Professor Klepek.
Hunter says that you live in Cuba, it doesn't matter what the subject that you're actually speaking on is. All of the questions and question period are about Cuba, which says something, I think, about where we sit at the moment. George Lambie is going to talk about more on the historical side, although I am a historian, and so you'll see the problems that arise when historians try to deal with the present and the future shortly. But what I would like to put my emphasis on is what where I might have some comparative advantage coming from the field at the moment, and that is what I think are changes and trends in the forces at the moment. But I, as a historian, I can't resist saying to, as an introduction, that I do sense and feel very strongly that the armed forces are the central institution of the Cuban state, the key to the future of any succession and transition. It's already been a succession, of course, but there'll be another one. And that they are they have a range of advantages that they offer to the Cuban state and to the revolution that simply no other institution could come close to, and even the party. And, of course, they have the enormous advantage of being popular and being seen as a forward-thinking institution rather than being, I wouldn't say unpopular. The party is not, I think, unpopular, but the party is certainly seen as being anchored to a way of looking at things which is not necessarily in keeping with youthful thinking on where the country should go. That institution, I would say in the recent historical sense, has probably more than even other institutions in Cuba and the Cuban people in general suffered massively from the loss of the Soviet connection. The Soviet armed forces simply remade the Cuban forces. And while I wouldn't suggest that Cuba is not always Cuba and that the Cuban armed forces are not 100% Cuban, nonetheless, the 30 years of professional nationalization, which in the Cuban sense meant a great deal of Sovietization, produced an armed forces entirely out of keeping with the Cuban tradition before 1959, although it can be argued, I think, with some force, very close to the revolutionary traditions of the armed forces before the Cuban state was actually established. So if you can stand that much on 19th century and early period, what the special period did, of course, was shatter the fuel situation, shatter the training situation for the armed forces, shatter the ammunition, spare parts, replacement of equipment and weaponry, cut its links with the international socialist, at least, intelligence system, and the list could go on about just what happened to the Cuban armed forces. But perhaps most dramatically, and certainly for a historian, the most dramatically, is that for an authoritarian regime, I have a group of graduate students working on this. For an authoritarian regime, perhaps the most remarkable thing is that the cuts of huge cuts that no other country in Mrs. Thatcher's peace dividend era experienced, cuts of 70-75% perhaps of total strength and very significant ones in the reserves as well, that this was done with high morale, with no visible disturbances, and that far from having taskings reduced under the special period, that is the period since the fall of the Soviet Union, of the Soviet connection, those tasks have been increased. They've been increased in terms of what I consider confidence-building measures with the United States in cooperation in illegal immigration and in narcotics and even in weather a little bit. They have been increased, of course, in the armed forces' massive entry into the economy, including, of course, agriculture, which it had been in for a long time, but where its role was dramatically increased. So hugely cut a defense budget by 40% in the first 18 months, and then massively further to a third of its previous value. Well, in fact, more of value, because those figures are in pesos, which have collapsed as well. Well, I suppose the things that most strike one are that morale held on and the forces held on. They took the new taskings to heart and kept up with the old ones as well in quite remarkable fashion. Recruitment is good, I will argue, perhaps too good for the armed forces, and that at the moment things are looking up, despite the fact they're still overtasked. There are accusations of corruption, which I believe at lower levels are undeniable. But it is very easy to exaggerate how badly things might be going. I think there are, in fact, some signs of improvement. But I'll suggest that there are a number of ones that are problems. First issue, as I would like to say, is the strategic. At the strategic level, as I think most of you know, Cuba has La Guerra de Todo el Pueblo since 1980 as its official defense posture. But in many ways, that's merely an opening up, an expansion of the reserve side of the armed forces, a vital portion on the Vietnamese model of significant and sustained resistance to any invasion. That is the war of all the people, that somehow the armed forces are merely a hub around which the spokes of national defense are actually organized. And in personnel terms, there's no doubt that is Cuba's case. But of course, as I'm sure all of you know, reserve forces require training as well. And the idea is that one will deter the United States from attack. Optimists say defeat it in case of attack. I think those are only optimists. But certainly deter the United States by attack by making le jeu ne vaut pas la chandelle. That is, this game is not worth the candle that's required to conduct it, and that therefore cooler heads will prevail in Washington, and the argument of deterrence will be added to other arguments and mean that no invasion will in fact ever occur. That system, of course, is really Cuba's system since early 1960, but in the 1980s, under the impact of President Reagan's speeches and writings on the rollback of communism, this was made very, very much more explicit, and a huge system of reserves, perhaps 800,000, is established for in a country which in those days had less than 10 million, now has 11.6 million, was really quite extraordinary and revolutionary in Latin American terms. The problem is, of course, that it depends on a large regular force being able to hit those who are coming in on the beaches, and our large regular reserve force able to then conduct a defense in depth. Now, Cuba hasn't got a lot of strategic depth for reasons that everyone knows from the map, but it has some, and certainly with a massive, well-trained reserve, it could imagine itself doing reasonably well for a little bit of time, or at least its thinkers imagine such a thing to be possible. I believe that what has been seen is with the 18 years of the special period, as it's called, and the collapse of so much in the forces, that the forces were not willing or able to conduct significant training during that period at massive level. And that therefore, while it's shocking to think of an over 200,000-man force reduced to 55, 60,000, absolutely extraordinary in the special period, it's perhaps in the reserve force on which the basis of defense rests that the problem is even greater. And that is, not only is there not regular stiffening, as they say in the armed forces, that you would expect, because there aren't enough regulars, but because there hasn't been an availability of training, fuel, et cetera, for the reserve forces that there even has been for the regulars. In more recent years, however, that started to change, and I think it's part of a policy and a defense posture change with a series of bastiones. These are exercises every second year which try to build up particularly reserve capacity to work with the regulars, but also experience in collective training at a large level. And these started in 2004. This is the first major exercise that involves a reserve since 1988. These dates are not accidental in my mind. 16 years for a country that bases its defense posture on reserve forces is a very long time indeed without large exercises. And my own view is that they couldn't have an exercise of that kind with morale and conditions as they existed in the worst years of the special period. But enough work had been done by 2004 to have that. And it was really quite a success. In 2006, one hurricane discombobulated, to use an academic term, the attempt to have another one. But Fidel's illness perhaps told us more than anything else, at which 200,000, roughly, reservists were mobilized, something, again, quite extraordinary, in key positions in the hours and days after Fidel's illness had its effect of his temporary resignation, which became permanent. And then, of course, in 2008, we've had another postponement because of three hurricanes and one tropical storm coming in rapid order and affecting over 70% of the national territory with above minimum hurricane winds. So I don't think many countries have faced that in such a rapid succession. And when you think that the armed forces have the primary role in natural disaster relief, you can imagine the impact that's had, and this has caused the postponement of the exercise. And so 2009 is now the year of defense preparation. It's been declared as that, and it's the time when you will bring those 5 years of bastion exercises together and push it down to the lowest level of the reserves and see if you can actually conduct a very significant training and preparation. A huge PR coverage at the moment, and it's remarkable. You can see the new vehicles that have come in from China. You can see the soft-skinned vehicles, I should say, not armored vehicles. You can see new uniforms and weapons that are very shiny and very good marching and the rest of those good things that look terrific on television. And certainly the budget is up to pre-1992 levels. However, in moneda nacional, in local pesos, which are worth 24 to 1 pre-1989 levels. So you want to take that with a grain of thought. The negative trends then that I see. When you cut from 200,000+ to 50,000+, the number of people you have to take into the forces, needless to say, per year, declines. Firstly, the service is already cut in the early 60s from 3 years to 2 years, but also the number of people being brought in is really very small. The percentage of Cuban youth reaching 18 to 20 years of age that goes into the regular army as conscripts has been reduced to very few indeed. We don't have a figure for it. And that means that you are not getting the input into the reserve system as well as into national defense that you had got for the 30 previous years. That is, hundreds of thousands of young men who had 3 years with the colors and who therefore had plenty of time to become soldiers and reasonably professional at their job. Because you have such a small intake, why is it so small? Well, because of the 55,000, obviously, but also because many people are staying. Three square meals, reasonable recreation facilities, some access to a few special goods at moneda nacional prices, not at a convertible peso prices. And it's, no accommodation in Cuba is very good, but the accommodation's not that bad, at least for military people within the armed forces. So a number of young men are seeing, and young women, because they go in, obviously not as conscripts, but they go in large numbers in the Cuban armed forces. A number of people, of course, see this as a very positive way of living. Salaries are up as well. And so the recruitment is no problem. The problem with recruitment not being any problem is you're not inserting into the reserve forces or into the community at large a large number of people who would be the base for Guerra de Todo el Pueblo, for the war of all the people, which is the national strategy of defense, but more importantly, of deterrence. So we now have also armed forces that not only have that difficulty, but who have been given all these new taskings. If you have this large body of young people coming up, you also have needs. Many more people are being asked to do trabajador social, that is, to become trabajadores sociales, which is a social job of helping in the community, but which has only 5 weeks of what they call the previa, local training, to do before they go off and do this. They do not become, in any sense, soldiers. The Ejército Juvenil de Trabajo, the same thing, the youth labor army, 5 weeks of training, and off they go. And many people simply don't get conscripted at all. Or they go into MININT taskings, that is, the Ministry of the Interior taskings, which can be anything from firemen to immigration officials to fumigators in the huge anti-dengue campaign that has been so successful in Cuba and unfortunately not attempted elsewhere. All of these mean that you're not inserting people with military experience who are either inclined towards a voluntary reserve or who are going to go into it, or who know very much about the armed forces. And yet, Guerra de Todo el Pueblo remains as a defense posture and deterrent strategy of the country. And it's now 15 years. So we're now talking about a generation of young people who have not had military training. And I think that we have to consider as problematical for future of the armed forces and for the defense posture as it currently stands. The positive side. As I mentioned, morale is extremely high, particularly in the officer corps. The Chinese role is very appreciated. Yes, Cubans understand they're not going to get heavy tanks from anybody, and they're not going to get super-duper new ships or aircraft for a while. But the Chinese, just having transport in decent vehicles is revolutionary after so many decades. There's also a small potential Russian role, probably in repair more than anything else, for the very old Soviet equipment that the Cubans have. Not necessarily bad equipment, certainly robust and long-lasting, that's for sure. There are women's recruitment is very high. Lots of interest in maintaining that. And, of course, the social structures. In the Cuban officer corps, if you come in through the school system, the military school system, 50% of all students must be sons of or daughters of workers or peasants. So that is functioning, I think, very well. The military hospitals are on their feet again after some very difficult times. Infrastructure is being improved remarkably to the extent the hurricanes of this year will permit it, so people are a bit more comfortable. The pay is up, as I mentioned. Three naval craft are now serving with the fleet. The mine layer is being repaired somewhat slowly. And fuel is up, training is up, transport is up, all arms cooperation is up, people are doing things. But that does not mean that the main problems have gone away. So I think we see many positive but many negative, perhaps a negative since we were so accustomed to the ghastly circumstances of the 1990s and early 2000s that any improvement seems remarkable, rather like the reforms that Raoul has brought in. And I would just finish saying a word about Raoul, if you can stand it. The forces do feel that their man is at the top. They never felt that they didn't have their man at the top in the sense of Fidel being the commandante in jefe, commander-in-chief. But there's no doubt that the forces are among those who benefit from Raoul's matter-of-fact, straightforward approaches rather than the micromanaging, lots of blah-blah and not too much effective operation of things in the previous leadership, shall we call it. The armed forces feel that they're on high in the sense of their budget may be still a disaster, but in reasons we don't know because there is no opening auditing of the defense budget or anything like it in Cuba, but we know that some funds must come to the armed forces from the enterprises that they that they run, if only in the context of payment for the officers and senior NCOs who do some of these taskings. The armed forces do feed themselves, of course, entirely. They don't have to purchase food, and the Venezuelan situation allows for all kinds of fuel, even if it's not as valuable as it used to be. And, of course, the Chinese situation is really very helpful in terms of equipment. The corruption issue remains, and is one which there's much more heat than light, even within Cuba. And it's at two levels. One that doesn't concern, I think, the forces very much, although it has attracted more attention in the north, and that is that there are senior officers involved and not-so-senior officers involved in the running of enterprises with foreign capital or even without, and that these people with the temptations that one has seen in everywhere else in Latin America have succumbed and have created a new caste of officers very divorced from what we might call line officers who are still with units. I don't think that this is as serious as it's sometimes made up to be for, or at least suggested it is, for two reasons. One, the casualty rate among those caught and the level of wound that they receive as a result of engaging in this has been very serious indeed. So there's a deterrent effect. And the second one is that Cubans, if they are anything, represent el pueblo chiquito, infierno grande, a concept that I'm sure most of you know. That is, Cubans, the national sport is not baseball, whatever they say. It's not even sex, whatever everyone else says. It is gossip. That is a national sport. And if you want to keep up with the Joneses in Cuba, you have a problem that you don't have in the rest of the world. You have to make sure that the new vehicle you bought arrives at 2 a.m., not at 2 p.m., so that nobody sees it rather than that everybody sees it, because it will get out instantly that you are living slightly, even slightly higher on the hog. So I think there are deterrence effects to that. What there is no deterrent effect is low-level corruption. The sergeant, even the corporal, who has access to that little bit of extra food, that little bit of extra cement, etc., and who is selling that or to supplement his still meager salary at this moment. And that, of course, creates a kind of generalized undisciplined structure within a generally very disciplined armed forces, which the Cubans are. I think that, summing up, we have a number of trends that the Cubans are worried about and perhaps should be more worried about. The demographics are not good, but that's longer term. Cuba has the same kind of population spread that the North has. It's a very developed country in many ways. And long term there may be problematical as well. But particularly the fact that you maintain a defense posture based on guerra de todo el pueblo, when really these possibilities of el pueblo to sustain that trained manpower input into the strategy is not there. The great hope in Cuba at the moment is, of course, the election in a certain country of a new president who is on everybody's lips and who it is felt might signal change, and that Cuba would not need to maintain what is a ferociously expensive deterrence structure even at the moment, and would open things to better relations. The armed forces are at the front of this debate, are at the front of those suggesting that Cuba must be more than ready to engage in those negotiations, and that the armed forces, perhaps because of the linkages between United States security and armed forces and Cuban armed forces already, might be one means to pave the way to more cooperation. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Klapak. Dr. Lambie?
Thank you. After leaving an unseasonably frozen London yesterday, I hoped I might get some respite in Washington, but stepping out of the hotel, I found the coldest temperatures I've ever experienced. Anyway, I'm delighted to be here with you and have a chance to speak on the Cuban military. I decided when writing this that I would give a historical perspective, firstly because I'm not technically a specialist on the Cuban military, but also I feel that to get some insights into the sense the military has is of itself and actually the Cubans have of their own military, it's probably be quite helpful just to go through some of the major historical aspects of this development. The rebel army that entered Havana in 1959 saw itself as the rightful victors in a 100-year struggle for national self-determination, 100 years of frustrated nationalism, as it's been termed by someone. And this was also underpinned by the ideas of one of Latin America's greatest intellectuals, José Martí. And I think that this concept of having a legitimate victory by force of arms is something that's carried on right to the military today, who see themselves very much in the same vein. And this is a very important aspect, I think, when one considers the military's self-identity. However, what I'd like to do is to really look at another aspect of the military's background and development, and that is to consider the forces that the military or the rebel army were up against in 1959, in the 1950s in Cuba, and to examine the system which they overthrew. Now, there are several things about this system in Cuba that are different from the rest of Latin America. And the first thing I would identify, that certain historians have pointed out, there was no actual oligarchy or ruling elite in Cuba that was clearly defined. The sugar plantocracy in the War of Independence was very much undermined. And then when huge swathes of American capital came into Cuba later on in the early 20th century, this really sort of eliminated what was a ruling elite, an oligarchy, which in the rest of Latin America are still prominent, and many of the big families are still very key players in politics and economics. So in Cuba, really, this class was almost absent. You can more or less say the same about the middle classes, even though the middle classes were quite dynamic. Again, American capital, American business had taken over a lot of that part of the economy that could have been dominated by the middle classes. And in some ways, the refuge for the middle classes was politics and administration, and the whole political system became one of turns. Inevitably, there became high degrees of corruption in this system. And in fact, Castro railed in his History Will Absolve Me speech about the corrupt middle classes and about the fact that they had not really played a proper role in society. Moving to the army, the Cuban army was, I suppose, fairly traditional national force up to about the 1930s, but then the revolt of Batista, the army sergeant, really in some ways undermined the army. It no longer became a clearly national force. It became more an agent of Batista's kind of political plans and the people he put into power and so on. So that lost some of its coherence. And again, if we look at the rest of Latin America, usually, although the middle class is not particularly strong, they usually have some sort of economic base. And also the military is extremely powerful in Latin America. They are either are the defenders of the status quo, they can move into a right-wing military dictatorship, they can be a rather paternalistic, if not incompetent, sort of manager of government or be in government. And even in some cases, like Velasco in Peru, they can move to a radical wing and become kind of a progressive reformist force. In Cuba, however, the army faded away. In fact, the whole system in some ways fell away when the rebel army, this ragtag army, often of people, probably 80% of them peasants from the interior, turned up in Havana, this rather unlikely force, the system which they challenged was very weak. Havana in the 1950s was an incredibly glitzy place, I think more Cadillacs per head than even southern US cities and various other statistics that are amazing, and anyone who can remember those days no doubt remembers an amazingly modern and dynamic city. But in effect, the structure of politics in Cuba and the economy and so on were very weak. So when the rebel army entered Havana, the system started to fade away. There was no sufficient consistency or determination within that system to provide a clear counter-revolution. And that was proven really in 1961 at the Bay of Pigs when the rebel army defeated an invading force. Now, in the 1960s, or at the beginning of the revolutionary process, this kind of amateur, rather unskilled army, led by fairly amateur leaders, even though obviously Fidel Castro and Che Guevara and his brother Raul were people with a great deal of determination and so on, a very clear idea of what they wanted to do, a lot of the power of this collapsed and disintegrating society was handed over to rather inexperienced people, as I say, many people from the countryside who had really got very little expertise or even very little education. And they had to run factories, they had to take over parts of administration, they had to take over sections of society that would be unimaginable to them previously. And Fidel Castro, in the memoirs that he'd recently written through secondhand, has mentioned this was a period of anarchy in many ways. But in some ways, from Castro's perspective and some of the leaders' perspective, that didn't really matter so much, because more important than efficiency was the building of a revolutionary consciousness, the fact that people could become involved in the remaking of society and become part of that process. This has always been so central to the thinking of Fidel Castro, that people become involved and get a conscious association with this process. And of course, it was the rebel army that were the key players in this. They were taking over all kinds of aspects of Cuban society, attempting to manage them. Che Guevara, in fact, one of the key comandantes, became head of the National Bank and also the economy ministry and so on, and I think was slightly befuddled to start off with, particularly in the National Bank, not knowing what to do and not knowing anything about finance. But the point was, there was a kind of revolutionary incentive there, the idea that you had to become engaged and there was something very important that you had to develop. Even the Communist Party, whereas they could have been a challenge from the left, and the Communist Party in Cuba was a very big Communist Party, quite powerful, the leadership, the hierarchy, had not really supported the revolution. The rank and file had been part of the revolution, but the Communist Party was accepted later on the terms of the rebel army and the terms set by the Castros and so on. It was not something that entered the system with any particular power or influence to change things. So really what I'm saying is that the rebel army entered Havana for historical reasons with rather a clean slate, and so it could take over a whole series of things to start to develop this notion of a revolutionary consciousness among the people and a symbiotic link between the army, the people, the new institutions and so on. These things were no longer distinct. They were things that worked and operated theoretically together. An idea which was expressed by Guevara in his rather romantic notion of the idea of a new man or a new person, a person that would have a different concept of what their role was in civil society. Now, as the 1960s developed, there was a great deal of experimentation in the 1960s. They experimented with all kinds of cooperative mechanisms of bringing the population into the process, increasingly of managing society. And again, a lot of these things were failures, but at least they carried on the notion that there was a revolution going on and there were all sorts of activities going on that people had a part in. It was a civilian kind of process. This ended really in the experiment of the 10 million ton harvest in 1970, when the Cubans hoped to produce 10 million tons of sugar, both to take advantage of high prices for sugar on the world market, and also, I would argue, more so as a kind of ultimate experiment in social cooperation, the idea that this was the campaign of campaigns that would bring all Cubans together. And there was a huge input from the military, who were principally the organizers of this campaign, and it was something really which Fidel Castro staked his methodology or his reputation on. Now, this harvest failed. Technically, it only failed by sort of 1.5 million tons, but where it really failed, it disrupted society. Society couldn't cope with all these kind of demands. People were fed up of the exhortations for voluntary labor and commitment. It started to create a whole series of problems. And certainly from the 1970s onwards, there was a change, a significant change. And Cuba moved closer to the Soviet Union. Someone has written an article suggesting that there's been a Sovietization of Cuba in the 1970s. I don't think it quite went as far as that. But certainly Cuba moved much closer to the Soviet Union. It joined the Council for Mutual Economic Assistance in 1972 and so on. Now, what this meant was, if you like, not an abandonment, but less emphasis on this collaborative process, this civilian process in society. And the army and the population were moved into sort of positions where they could be better identified and where they could express themselves. In the case of the population, they were given people's power, the Cuban local government system, in which they theoretically could make democratic choices and decisions at the local level and represent themselves. They were less represented in the direct running of a society as they had been in the 1960s. The army itself was also, it became more technical. It received more Soviet equipment. It was something which became more of a traditional army in many respects. In the 1970s, the army is still involved in a lot of civilian enterprises and activities and so on, but basically it was put more into a traditional role. In fact, it became one of the best equipped armies in Latin America and also one of the most efficient ones, which was proven certainly at the end of the 1980s at the famous Battle of Cuito Cuanavale in Angola, where the Cuban and Angolan forces defeated a very powerful force led by South Africa and UNITA and so on. Now, what I would say about the 1970s, that towards the end of the 70s, and particularly in the 1980s, there was a feeling among the leadership that somehow Cuba had become too technical, it become, too Sovietized in many respects, and there was a need to move back towards a period of, in Castro's terms, consciousness building, involving the population, trying to make a more integrated revolution rather than one that was separated and now more controlled by kind of technical bureaucrats than it had been in the past. This was also really reinforced by after the invasion of Grenada in 83, because what happened after the invasion of Grenada is that Cuba felt very alone. The Soviet Union didn't make the right kind of responses, and there was a sense maybe that, you know, a day might come when the Soviet Union would no longer be the reliable partner that it was. There was also the so-called rectification campaign of 1986, which was really an ideological development in which Fidel Castro wanted to promote, as I say, an increasingly participative and conscious involvement of the population in the revolution and start bringing those elements which had been separated in some ways, including the military, back into this Cuban family of participation and cooperation, the sort of thing that he imagined was a true revolutionary process. Now, the 1980s was a period of uncertainty in Cuba, even though for those who lived in Cuba, it was probably the period where they had the high standard of living and life was quite good during this period. But towards the end of the 80s, it was starting to become clear that Cuba's support of the Soviet Union was probably in a difficult position itself, and if that got worse, then Cuba would probably be abandoned. And so certain measures started to be taken which sought to bring society together. There was one, the food program, the Plan Alimentario, which was set up, in which the army became deeply involved and citizens and institutions, organizations were persuaded to grow their own food to try and deal with what I regard as one of Cuba's greatest problems, its inability to be self-sufficient in food. When the final collapse came of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, absolutely nothing could have prepared Cuba for this catastrophe. In effect, the economy fell off a precipice and for 5 years was in free fall. And this created a situation, a desperate situation. As Hal mentioned, the army lost a lot of its equipment. It was no longer the force it was. It was reduced. It was massively cut back. And it faced an enormous amount of difficulties. Now, what I'd like to put forward, really, in the last part of this is to look at what I would regard as sort of four parallel processes which have been undertaken by the Cuban government since the collapse of the Soviet Union and during the special period, and really taking it up to now. The first thing, I think, was that because of this enormous economic contraction, that a state which controls virtually everything lost a great deal of its power to manage. The problem was that it could no longer get the supplies to the factories where people worked. It could no longer, for example, the claimed democracy in Poder Popular, the local government system, people could decide on how various materials and so on were distributed and demand certain things and have a degree of control over how the locality operated, this was no longer functional because there were simply no materials available. And there were simply, as I say, things not going into factories, so people were technically unemployed. Hundreds of thousands of people were technically unemployed. And the state had no real means of dealing with this. And it was inevitable that people went out in Cuban parlance hunting and gathering. People just went out to do what they could. A black market began to emerge. There was the emergence also of racketeering, which was around the black market. Most of the economy started to move in a dimension that the state could no longer have any control of. Now, to deal with this, the state had to take, in its view, some fairly unpalatable measures. And one was to introduce private enterprise, to allow people to become, you know, small businesses and so on, even though a lot of controls were put over this, to try and set up some sort of taxation system to control these things. And also the legalization of the dollar, because the dollar was running underground, and if the Cuban state didn't have some means of capturing this dollar, how would it tax it? How would it lift the revenues from this? It would simply keep the black market going. So all of these things were undertaken, and I would argue they were a temporary expedient, certainly in the mind of Fidel Castro, because they were something which was seen as unpalatable, a danger that the revolutionary family that had cohered for a reasonable amount of time for so long had, in fact, they didn't want a dimension which was the free market, a new emergent entrepreneurial class. This was outside of the spectrum of what was regarded as being the revolution. Now, on the other side, the second process I would identify is that there were three other processes that tried to counteract this. One was the use of the military. The military were trusted, the military were loyal, the military had a great deal of power and experience, had been highly trained. In fact, they were sent on training courses to Spain and all over the place to learn how to manage modern enterprises and so on. And the military then set up some rather big organizations in which they control sections of the economy. It's arguable they probably control something like 60% of the economy today. And there's particularly emphasis as well that they should control those dollar areas of the economy, tourism, various other areas, because these were the problematic areas where there was seepage into the black market and various other things. So kind of the military, firm hand was something that was regarded as being something important. And in my view, this is kind of, this is a strategy which is not just placing efficient people into a form of economic management for the sake of economic performance and profits and so on. It's rather to avoid the formation of a new entrepreneurial class in Cuba. The military have taken on that role to replace the possible emergence of a new capitalist class in Cuba, which certain members of the leadership so fear and feel that capitalism is a dangerous thing. You can't introduce it into socialism because if you do, it starts to make it come apart. And so that's what I would view the military's role is in many ways, both an economic role and also a political role. Now, the third process which I would identify is the government's encouragement of cooperative ventures, of the population to try and resolve its problem through cooperation. And one example of this, which I've looked a little bit at myself, is the development of peri-urban horticulture, the idea that you can, in an urban environment, open up some of the spaces that are not used and use those environments to grow vegetables and so on and various other things. Now, this was an extraordinary development because, you know, the Cuban diet was not really accustomed to all of these things of the vegetables and so on. It's very much a diet dominated by kind of pork and rice and beans. In fact, one Cuban who was a nutritionist once said to me, Cuba's worst enemies are pork, rice, beans, and U.S. imperialism in that order. So this was very problematic, but nevertheless, the Cubans really took this on board. And I think the development in organic farming was extraordinary in many ways in this peri-urban production. It's arguable how much food it produced and how much difference it made and so on. But it was very important to the process that the government wanted to develop was that there were going to be collective, cooperative means to resolve some of the problems. Again, the military became involved in this. I certainly saw the military operating to try and help to develop some of the organiponicos, which were mainly based of raised beds and so on. They would bring in the soil. And the military itself, of course, has its own agricultural operations and even has its own market, which becomes parallel to the private farmers' market so it can keep prices in check and so on. So this was the the third process. Now, the fourth process I would identify is probably slightly more difficult to define, but I think it's Cuba's external strategy. Since the 1980s, Cuba shifted from an external policy, a foreign policy of maybe armed involvements in countries and so on, to one of winning hearts and minds. And this was based very much around the delivery of health diplomacy and health care. Cuba's very good health care system, very well developed and so on, and particularly well adapted to implementation in developing countries. And Cuba, in fact, has operated in many countries in the world and provided the alarming, amazing statistics such as Cuba's got more health personnel abroad by the end of the 80s than the World Health Organization, provides more health aid than the G7 combined, and a lot of statistics that are out there suggesting that Cuba has a massive level of intervention. There's also the Latin American Medical School, which Cuba's developed, where a lot of people come from abroad to train there, and they have all sorts of initiatives in healthcare. Perhaps the most prominent example at the moment is Venezuela, where there are reputedly 30,000 personnel of various kinds that are operating in Venezuela to help Chavez with his misiones and his various programs. Now, I would suggest tentatively that the military are involved in this process as well, because I think that the wider vision, certainly of Fidel Castro, and I have a quote somewhere which I can't read out to you now because it's in my bag, but Castro always believed that somehow the globalization process was set to collapse. And it was a matter of hanging on and waiting till it happened. And what Cuba would do in the meantime, it would have strategic political interventions, the Hearts and Minds campaign, healthcare, and various other things, and try and insert itself in some way into those changes that were taking place, particularly in Latin America itself. And here, obviously, this is another role where the military plays a part. I wouldn't want to say how or why, because I don't really know. But one feels a sense that certainly in the Chavez coup of 2002, attempted coup, that the military played a significant role in preventing that from being a reality and so on. So what I would say about Cuba is that even though there are longings, I think, for certainly better relations with the United States and so on, better relations with Europe indeed, is that the Cuban Revolution, the Cuban leaders, are set in a certain set of strategies. These strategies might come off, but they are there. They are not just simply emergency measures. And I think the one strategy which holds out at the moment, and probably it's very unfortunate that Fidel is now ill and probably may expire in the next year or so, is that it was his vision that globalization somehow would fail. And if globalization failed, then Cuba would have an opportunity to insert itself into an international arena in which, in some ways, the revolution might be changed, but nevertheless, there would be a certain continuity in the way that it developed. Now, I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Mora?
Thank you, Peter. As the lone non-historian in the group, I will talk in variables and causation and bore the hell out of all of you. In the time I have, I am going to talk actually in variables a little bit and think about causation as we think about the military and be perhaps a bit provocative at the risk of also the tomatoes that that Hal talked about. And I want to sort of identify three key variables and developments, trends, as my colleagues have mentioned, in the fore that I think have transpired or at least come to the fore since July 2006 when Fidel temporarily gave up power and then, of course, eventually permanently gave up power or stepped down from his formal positions. Let me list those three and then go through each of them. The first variable is to look at the role of these younger generation of officers, general officers, that are now in the new regional commands that have been appointed to those commands in the last 12 months, and the role that they are playing and will have to play in the decision-making process, something that they had not been involved in before. Second variable, what I'm calling sort of the readjustments potentially, and there is some evidence, the potential readjustment in the historical role of the FAR, suggesting that even though the FAR is as powerful, as central as in fact the state today, that in fact in the 7 to 10 year time period, there are signs that it may just become just another institution among many, as part of this continuous succession process that we are seeing. And third, and the final variable I'll look at, are what are the consequences and outlook of what I have observed as recent international engagement by the FAR. Increasingly since 2000, actually I would say since 2002, the FAR, after a long period of being sort of very inward-looking, has now begun to engage the world and its colleagues in other parts of the world much more. And I'm going to make certain conclusions, actually not even more questions and assertions, about what this means for the institution. Now, the theme that I think links each of these three variables that many of you perhaps have seen me or heard me talk about in some of these sessions is that change and continuity are not incompatible when it comes to the FAR. It's that old Edmund Burke adage that for things to remain the same, they must change. And this is the institution of change in Cuba, I would argue. But not change for the sake of democracy or creating a capitalist society. It's an institution that understands that in order to survive, in order to maintain the status quo or the regime or the survival of the revolution, change is indispensable. Inflexibility, retrograde behavior is a recipe for disaster. And I think the FAR will remain the single most important agent of change, and I would say even of reform in Cuba. No other institution, I think, in Cuba, as my colleagues have indicated, better epitomizes the currents of change, of adaptation, of experimentation, of even reform, and those are things that continue to take place, than the FAR, including the party. One of the most conspicuous aspects of the revolutionary process in Cuba has been the increasing use of the military since day one until this present moment as an instrument of social, political, and economic mobilization, of experimentation, and change. And this is not simply a function of the last 15 years or the special period, but I would argue, and I'm segueing to my first variable here, the emergence of a new and very different generation of general officers that I think are exemplified by the three new regional commanders that I'll elaborate about in a second, that have very different and unique experiences, educational backgrounds, and I would go as far as to say interests than some of their more senior officers, let's call them los históricos. The military is the go-to institution. It's I like to say, the main think tank of the revolution. I'm reminded by what one senior FAR officer, retired FAR officer, mentioned in an article recently when he said, "Siempre ha habido un pensamiento renovador dentro de la FAR." There's always been this sense of, or this conscience of change and a renovation within the FAR. Okay, my first variable. I think the most important trend that we have seen in not just the last 2 years, but going back even further, is that the moment is fast approaching when this intermediate generation of general officers who were previously sort of executors of decisions and not decision makers is now becoming an integral part of the decision-making process. They are now going to be involved in the politics of decision-making in ways that they had not been involved in before, even though they were commanders in the military. A larger group of this generation, many of them promoted to general officer in the mid-1990s, are now in positions where a higher level of participation in decision, formulation, and decision-making of policy is expected. Now, again, this is not a process that just began in the last year or the last 2 years. Since the early 2000s, Raul Castro was often said on several occasions and fully acknowledged that these younger officers will, from their positions of command and political influence within the FAR, have the opportunity, according, and here I'm quoting directly, according to their experiences and interests, to think their own formulas of continuity or change in Cuba. End of quote. Now, there were those involved in the Sistema de Perfeccionamiento Empresarial, these economic reforms that were alluded by my colleagues, of these technocrats that were managing and reforming certain industries, military industries and non-military industries, people like Brigadier General Luis Perez, Luis Bernal, Eladio Fernandez Civico, that have been enjoying or exercising some policy influence, but specifically and somewhat narrowly in the economic sector. In the military, I think this process has accelerated, if not intensified, as can be best demonstrated with the changes in the three regional commands, all of which, by the way, replaced senior, very senior historical figures who had been in those posts for, in some cases, more than 20 years. They were all, the Leopoldo Cintar Frias, Espinosa Martin, Quinta Sola, were Army Corps generals whose credentials date back to the time of days of the rebel army. In the case of Cintar Frias and Espinosa, they were Politburo members. All this meaning that these commanders had been involved in policy in the political process for some time by virtue of their seniority, positions in the FAR, historical credentials and relationships, membership in party post, etc. Those individuals have now been replaced by folks that are, in one case, in their late 40s and mid-50s. These are people who don't have experience of the rebel army. And so their outlook is quite different. And something that I like to look at is to look at the backgrounds of the individuals to see how perhaps they are thinking about the institution and about Cuba. Just a quick note about those three older regional commanders. As you know, they have been replaced. They've been made now a part of the general staff as vice ministers. Cintra Frias, the commander of the Western, former commander of the Western Army, becoming the first vice minister. These three individuals, along with the Minister of Defense, the general chief of the general staff, Lopez Miera, and the heads of the Navy and the Navy are all folks that are at a minimum 65 years of age, if not much older, in their 70s. Right. So the very senior level of the military is still the historicals, right? And in fact, I think what we might see is that the Rear Admiral Perez Betancourt, who is, by the way, 69 and head of the Marina, is, as I understand, likely to be replaced by the current chief of the Western Naval District. So there is now some renovation. So the MINFAR still remains in the hands of these older generations with very few exceptions. These historicals were not educated under the notion that, quote, el partido es la fuerza renovadora, la fuerza rectora de la sociedad. These were individuals that didn't think that the party was at the head of this, that they felt that it was the army. The army was central to the process, that everything else in the government, administration, and party and the party was something secondary to the FAR. So these notions concerning party and government came later and are rooted more effectively in the minds of a younger generation of flag officers. These generals, especially Onelio Aguilera Bermudez, who is now the new commander of the Eastern Army, former chief of staff there, and is in his late 40s, He is, I think, the archetype of this generation of general officers that do not see themselves, here's the key, or the FAR separate or in relationship to the power structure. The FAR is part of the power structure, right? It is complementing the power structure, but unlike their superiors, they do not think that the FAR, perhaps in the future, will be the bulwark of the state, or in fact will be the state, as many of these older officers believe. No, this group has been educated, disciplined on a very different institutional setting where notions of conflict, war, and securities have changed considerably. The picture is very different. My view of this for them is very different. They simply were not part of the rebel army, as I said earlier, or the FARC's early days. They had no personal grasp and understanding of power and politics like their superior. They were the executors of policy. They were the followers. Now they are the leaders. So the participation of these new commanders, again, in the past role was to comply with orders. They never really participated in policy other than discussions in the National Defense Councils, and now they are expected to engage and to participate. And they will bring to the table, my view, different perspectives into the discussion. But their views may also change as they become more directly involved in policy and politics. Nevertheless, they have different perspectives and will likely attack a problem or address a problem from a very different and perhaps much more modern perspective than their seniors. Just to give you just the sort of background to one of these individuals, which is this Division General Aguilera Bermudez, who is now the chief of the Eastern Army. When Cuba watchers look at the faces of Raul and Machado Ventura and some of the other leaders of the old guard in the Council of State, I think they tend to draw a very wrong conclusion. There's no question that the old leadership remains very much in place. But if one carefully examines the leadership ranks within the FARC, and I would add into the party and government, one will notice that that conclusion about where power really lies or will lie in the next few years, you should probably come to a different conclusion. These younger generations have already and continue to have taken over almost all the existing power structure in the party, at the provincial and central committee, ministers and vice ministers, head of different directorates and corporations. These are indisputable evidence that such a change is in the making. And I think Aguilera Bermudez proves this point. He's the youngest of the three, as I said, in his late 40s, promoted to Brigadier General in 2006 and recently promoted to Division General. He is a Camilito, right? He was a cadet in this kind of high school Cuban ROTC that motivates and guides students into military academies. And in fact, Raul Castro referred to these individuals, again, that are in command positions as individuals who will be in charge of the key directorates of the general staff. Very well respected, and someone who has a lot of experience in Africa. Now, a common feature to these three commanding officers is that they have not held, as I said earlier, political positions. None of them are members of the Politburo. They're not even members of the Central Committee, I believe. Their social and family backgrounds are extremely modest. Men who have experienced the shortages and the challenges and the hardships of average Cuban citizens during the special period. This is true of the other two, Rafael Bello and Lucio Morales. And it will be interesting to see at the end of the year at the Six-Party Congress whether these individuals will become not just army leaders, but party leaders as well. Will they be, some of them, appointed to the Politburo? One other point here on this variable. These rising officers are much less part of that old civic soldier tradition that Jorge Dominguez talked about a long time ago. And that was very much a part of the older group. That is to say, these are soldiers who felt comfortable working in the administrative economic sectors as they did commanding officers. These new officers throughout their careers have been much more focused and committed to being military commanders. They have little or no experience in economic activity, running a business, an enterprise, or, of course, in politics, unlike some of their contemporaries that do and are involved in this. So one important conclusion, when these officers participate in the discussion, decision-making aspects or process dealing with the economy, they will be more inclined to be cautious, moderate, and risk-averse because of their lack of experience. Okay, second variable. And here, I think, is looking forward. I think that in 7 to 10 years' time, the FAR, as I said earlier, will gradually, and I want to emphasize gradually, stop being what it is today. The backbone, the bulwark, the most powerful institution of the revolution, and gradually become another part or component of the power structure. Again, it's worth repeating, as my colleague just said, the rebel army, the FAR, has been the institutional foundation, the principal instrument of the revolution's goals and objectives. Conflict, war, security was very much shaped and molded their perspectives and their experiences. They were the only, or considered the only, source of leadership, guidance, legitimacy, admiration, all the rest, even through the 1960s and 1970s as the party increased. This, I think, is changing. There is, I sense, an ongoing debate within the institution about what is the possible model for the future once the historical revolutionary elite passes from the scene because of biology. Will it be the Chinese-Vietnamese model? Will it be one more like the Latin American? I'll get to that in a second. And there's even some talk from some, I think, small circles of the Burmese model. I can elaborate that in the question and answer. There is some evidence based largely on the outlook and experiences of these new officers rising to the highest levels of the institution, government, and likely party. They understand that the FAR's historical role is going to be very different as the domestic and global context changes, particularly if there is a normalization of relationships with the United States. The old model, that is to say, the old FAR's model, historical, is not sustainable in the 5 to 10 year period. And they will have to decide whether FAR will remain what it is today, in effect a state, or will it become another institution of the power structure. The sense I get from looking and closely at these officers is that they see themselves more as part of the overall structure and not, as I said earlier, the state. They're not the architects or the founding fathers, as it is or was, but it will unleash, as a process of modernization, create a new role for the institution. Now, this doesn't mean they're going to give up managing industries. I don't think they see this as incompatible or a contradiction. In fact, as you know, in Asia and Latin America, militaries are involved in the economic sectors, and there's no reason to believe that they're so much going to hand over the 80 to 82 enterprises they currently control. Third variable, quickly. And this is more an open question than an assertion that I'm making. In the period immediately after the end of the Cold War, after the collapse of the socialist bloc, the FAR's international engagements and commitments declined significantly. Hal could correct me on this, but I think there were fewer than 5 embassies where you found Cuban military attachés. So there was a contraction for all the reasons that have been talked about already. Since the early 2000s, however, there has been a broadening of the FAR's international relations and commitments, and not just about Venezuela, where indeed the interaction is intense, particularly from MININT and from FAR. I think it's enormous. Just to give you one example, the FAR went into the Venezuelan War College, restructured the curriculum, and now the doctrine, the posture is, guess what? War of all people, which, of course, Chavez has talked about. Now, this cooperation and interaction is on the upswing, certainly with the Chinese, with the Vietnamese, with the Namibians, etc. But of most noteworthy is the interaction with Latin American militaries. I'm not really talking about training or arms sales or anything, but a vast number of courses, agreements, conferences, invitations that we've seen in recent years. And particularly with the Brazilians. I was struck by how many military officers went with Raul Castro to the summit in Brazil. So the question, and again isn't a question, is what impact will this broader, more intense relationship have on the FAR's outlook and on these younger generations that I mentioned earlier? The different schools of thought in Latin America about civil-military relations and military missions, I think, could potentially influence Cuban military officers, particularly this younger generation. And this opens, I think, opportunities for various perspectives and outlooks to emerge. So to conclude, it is here that I think a return to the previous discussion of changes that we might see over the next 7 to 10 years is most important. If a modern institution is what these new senior officers seek, whereby the institution is no longer the center of power, then what model will the FAR pursue from the vast number that they have studied and closely observed over the last number of years, and that have come as a result of this broadening relationships and interactions with Latin and Asian militaries?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, the floor is open for questions. Please state your name and your affiliation as you ask your question. This gentleman in the front row.
Thank you. My name is Jordi Zamora. I'm a journalist from Agence France-Presse. First of all, I want to congratulate. It was extremely interesting and very different point of view, depending on each panelist. My question is it's very related to the current affairs, as you may guess. It's about this recent trip of Raul Castro to Russia. It was the first trip of a Cuban leader in 20 years. Some of you have already stated that military has changed and all this equipment from a technical point of view from the United Soviet Union has had to be repaired and they had to focus or to go to other sources of equipment. But it seems that they have signed some strategic papers in Moscow these days, Raul Castro and Putin. And do you think it could be possible they come back to this source, to this Russian source of technical stuff, but under a different, of course, set of conditions because the world has changed, but could they be rely on them again, and which extent do you think?
My own view is that the Cuban military have a great deal of experience with the Russians, and they do not wish to repeat it, like many other countries. They are very interested in the day-to-day, helicopter repair, spare parts. As you know, the Soviet-Chinese rift occurred exactly as Cuba was coming onto the scene to take in Soviet equipment. Much Chinese stuff developed since then is actually not compatible, much is. I think on the strategic level, Cuba is interested in anything which raises its profile, but not too high, in Washington and elsewhere, in terms of saying, well, we do have other opportunities and other possibilities, but we're not going to go crazy about them. So the Cubans appreciate Soviet equipment robustness, its longevity, and relative cheapness at the moment, and, of course, the fact that they have had connections in the past which can be relatively easily renewed, even at the personal level in some cases, with these very long-lived previous generation of officers. But I don't see them going down a route which would be dangerous in the context of the United States. Second point, if I may. Georgia was extremely damaging to the Russian reputation in the FAR. If you look at where the FAR looks to for efficiency in armed forces, it is to the United States. The United States is the model of a changing, adaptive, professional armed force that does things and does things reasonably well. This is not the 70s. And the armed forces in Cuba are very much admirers professionally of the way the United States armed forces over the last quarter of a century have improved. I'm not suggesting that they're thinking about buying United States equipment shortly. I don't think anyone dreams in that way. But my own view is that they will look for bits and pieces where they will have advantage. They are not impressed with Russian reform as it currently is, professionally speaking, that, of course, they have many links that they appreciate from the past, but that route has relatively little advantage if it's pushed too far and many disadvantages on the strategic level.
Once again, Hal's reading my mind. I totally agree on this particular issue of a certain level of distrust, I would go as far as to say, with the Russians. The Cubans have had, during the Cold War, several bad experiences in the sense that they simply cannot be relied upon. That and they've gotten burned on several occasions. I think some of them have been open and well known. So they will be, I think, very cautious on this issue of enhancing or returning to the kind of military strategic relationship that they once had. One, because they're not to be distrusted, and two, there's nothing to be gained, only perhaps the concern from Washington, and we don't want to get into that. So nevertheless, they will get and they will accept all the credits and all the repair equipment that the Russians are willing to give. And they will welcome them and speak highly of the Russians. But to go as far as to return to even something resembling the Cold War, I just simply do not see that at all.
Thank you very much. Question in the back, gentleman there.
My name is Antonio Galloso, and I'm a professor at GW. Perhaps in order to quiet my pessimism from with the three lectures, which were excellent, do you see in the next 10 years the FARC playing a role in opening society in Cuba, both from the economic standpoint and from the political standpoint, thinking and keeping in mind that nobody who has power likes to relinquish it?
I'm more optimistic for reasons that I think Frank, in his usual way, has very well brought out than I might be in some other example. Cuba is an extraordinary place as long as you don't think that it's so exceptional that it's absolutely unique. It's very helpful to keep that in mind. We do have armed forces which, in an extraordinary way, I mean, I don't want to go too far on this, but I don't know of another institution, never mind state, which in the midst of perhaps one of the most remarkable collapses to which Frank and George have both made reference historically that one can imagine, that is the special period in which the armed forces and security forces not only have their budget savaged, but their manpower savaged. That is not a normal authoritarian regime's way of reacting to crisis. It is exactly the opposite of the normal way of reacting, which is to dig in, expand your security capability, and hang on, which I think says a great deal about what kind of regime we're talking about in terms of its own perception of its acceptance by the public, not applause by the public, perhaps, but acceptance by the public. I think it can be a remarkable agent of change because of the kind of institution it is. It has shown the most extraordinary flexibility, as both my colleagues have shown over these 50 years, to do all manner of leaps and retreats and advances, etc. But has largely been, I think, the renovator to which Frank refers. I don't think it's impossible. What I do think, and in general, I think this is a point that worth making, is that context will determine what happens. If Cuba feels, regime or nation, that it remains under the same pressures of the destruction root and branch of the revolutionary project, armed forces of whatever generation will rally around the flag, in my view. We will continue to have military leadership. We will not have the civilian breakthrough into actual cupola command. Yes, of course, in commands of units, yes, but cupola. The cupola will be determined in its successive forms by the context of threat, both from a regime perspective and from a national perspective. If that context becomes more positive through, as Frank was mentioning, the United States reaction, to change on the island, then I think we might see really quite remarkable change. Because it's a military institution, it can be ordered to do things. And if the FARC have proven one thing, they can be ordered to do almost anything, and they will salute smartly and march off and do it, maybe badly, as George was pointing out, because they're not very good at some things, but they will march off and do it. And I think there is hope that this very much renovating force, which didn't like rectificación in many ways but got involved in it, and in many, many circles of the FARC, didn't like the increased role in the economy either in terms of will it do to the profession, where are we going, and other things we could talk about. So I wouldn't be optimistic But I think if context can be provided that would allow for it, there is some room for optimism.
International Crisis Group. Hal, just at the beginning you mentioned some increased interchange with respect to counter drugs and I assume also counterterrorism. And I'm curious, a lot of the interchange apparently is with Canadian and British military. And what I was curious about is whether or not you could discuss that a little bit more, and also whether that involves any of the younger generation, the regional commanders that Frank has been talking about.
Well, if I could start with the last bit, sir, everything involves it. When Cuba has stuff that drifts onto the shore, it mobilizes, a few weeks ago, 3,000 troops. 3,000 troops that scan, not to mention naval presence, that walk up and down the beaches, et cetera, both for its own internal domestic reasons, it doesn't want the stuff circulating, but also because it wants to show, particularly the United States, that it is extremely serious about these activities, and so that there is no commander, particularly Air Force commanders, although it might sound odd in terms of finding these craft more efficiently than the very small naval forces that are available, Coast Guard forces that are available. Every commander has an anti-narcotics tasking of significant dimension, but largely as a foreign policy tool to suggest to security forces in the United States that Cuba is the best collaborator in the Caribbean, not the worst, on this issue. As usual, it's, what do we call it, an age moment? The first point, excuse me, the first bit was...
Can you talk a bit about the exchange of the British?
The British have by far the largest program, and it is a multi-million dollar program, and it involves something relatively unusual that neither the Dutch nor the French have. The French program is reasonably sizable and survived the 2003 European Union difficulties, as did the British. But it brings both Cuba, UK experts to Cuba and Cuban specialists to the UK. And UK forces, Her Majesty's excise, all the drug-related agencies have actually instructed at the Capitan, I've forgotten the name of the Capitan, some Capitan's school for the Minint's anti-drug operations. It's a quite a sizable program which involves kit as well as people. But most of the informational exchange, for reasons that we all know, goes through these third parties. It's not that the commander in Guantanamo or the Tropas de Fuerzas de Guarda Fronteras rings up and says, would you mind passing this on to the U.S. Coast Guard? It's much more through the embassies and is a bit slow, which is one of the reasons why the FAR and the DEA agent, as well as the Coast Guard lieutenant commander who is in Havana, why they would like this to be made a little more direct. But I'm told completely, I hope it's not apocryphal, but it's certainly only conversational. I'm told that the Cubans are inventive, as in most things, in getting the point across to U.S. authorities that there is problem X or problem Y presenting itself that might be on the horizon not too far away. I don't know if that answers your question a bit.
Thanks. Anyone?
Yes. To answer the second question, it's important to remember that each of these three new regional commanders were the chief of staff of those three commanders before they assumed their commands. And it was these chief of staff that were directly, right, involved and responsible for the kind of cooperation that Hal was just talking about. It wasn't really the three older generals. It was these three individuals. And they, and this is one of the evidence that I try to show, it's one of the evidence that shows that these particular individuals see the benefits of closer cooperation with the United States. My Coast Guard friends here in the United States tell me that over the last 3 years, the cooperation with the Cubans could not be any better. They can't imagine, other than perhaps more resources, how the response from these three commands could have been more effective than it has been over the last 3 years. And so this particular experience that they've had, I think, also adds to this outlook that I was trying to describe in my remarks, that see the context much larger, perhaps don't carry as much baggage as their seniors do about relationships with the United States. And I think that that's part of the evidence that I said that tells me that in 7 years' time, the role of the FARC may be evolving into something perhaps quite different than we're seeing today.
May I just say that the FARC are also, and Minint, are extremely grateful for the quality of the U.S. Coast Guard presence that has been sent. The officers have been first class and have impressed the Cubans beyond measure about the United States' seriousness about cooperation.
I'm Margaret Hayes. I'm intrigued by this difference between the failure to revise the national security strategy, as it were, going to Venezuela and implementing the same, while simultaneously appearing to be developing a different approach, at least among these few folks that you've mentioned. You all are educators. To what extent is there new thinking in the school system, the training and other systems, so that, let's assume these three commanders disappear, is there something behind them, and what are they, and indeed are they looking at the British experience at doctrine and so forth to with an eye to incorporating some of that into some future arrangement?
I'll go ahead. I'll just mention one institution, CODEN, the Colegio Nacional de Defensa, which is the equivalent of the War College, National War College in Cuba. One of the things that I have been struck with what they do is they do studies. Their end is the whole class, I don't know how they call it, but the whole group is responsible for a global study, a school-wide study that's done every year. And one of the things that they're asked to do, and this report goes up the chain of command all the way to the top. So this is a study that's valued by the people at the highest levels of the government and the military. And one of the things they do is they don't look at strictly military issues. They have a much broader understanding and are responsible for writing a study that includes social and economic issues in Cuba. That is to say, they see security much broader than the threat from the United States. And one of the things they do is they map out, they go out throughout the country collecting evidence about social conditions in this province or in this city. And how does this relate to the challenges that we, the Cubans, are facing? How does this fit into our national security perspective? So there is, over the last, I think, 5 years, and again, Hal could confirm this, over the last 5 years, a sense of looking at national security in a much broader way and getting our senior officers very much involved on these kinds of issues and not just the old thinking of the United States and Cold War thinking. They take public opinion polls data, and they include that in their study. That study then is briefed to the highest levels, right? And I think this whole process, I think, forces a class or a group to think in modernizing ways, in new ways of thinking, as you indicated, right? And that is seeping, if you will, down. Not because they want to be sophisticated in their research. There is a need to do this kind of work. And I think that is changing attitudes at the very senior levels of the military.
I think these are Cubans. They're not Soviets. And, you know, it strikes me as always remarkable. In 88, the decision is made to found the Cadena, for example. And the decision is taken in 88 that the model will not be, and I'm not being chauvinistic here, not be the Soviet Union, but will be Canada. And who's brought into Corena at those courses are not military officers. 50% are military, Minint, youth organizations, the party, foreign ministry, and other industries that are crucial from a development perspective, and as they call it, the recuperation process from the special period. So I think the forces sense in a strong way, and have for some time, the need to look more broadly. And one of the complaints right back to Angola is that, of course, the Soviets, with their size, have always tended to think, well, we'll send this army corps that way, and these 18 squadrons of aircraft will involve that. And the Cubans are saying, but the South Africans only have 18 aircraft, and we only have 12. In case you're wondering, you might be thinking a little rather too high a level, something that I know, Margaret, you have faced in Latin America, in the juxtaposition between the United States and Latin American forces. I think that, yes, there is thought. There is a lot of modernizing thought, and in the forces institutes, that is, there's a lot of happening, and there's a lot of visits to the educational institutions, but usually to learn from Cuba rather than the opposite. I'm not quite so convinced that Venezuela is really serious about Guerra de Todo el Pueblo. I think it's much more flag-waving and getting excited, but certainly the Cuban model as a posture has appealed to them for all kinds of reasons.
Thank you. We have time for one more question. Gentlemen here.
Emilio Adolfo Rivero, New Cuba Coalition. I have questions for Professor Lambie and Professor Klepak. As to Professor Mora, I have no questions. You speculated very intelligent speculations, I think based in reality, and elements of those variants you mentioned, I think we're going to see them. My compliments, Professor Mora. I have a question. I'm going to mention the two questions for Professor Lambie and Professor Klepak. Professor Lambie, you mentioned the healthcare system in Cuba. Then, what do you think of the information we have been receiving from Cuba in the last 10 or 12 years that when a common citizen goes to a clinic or the hospital, he has to bring sheets, towels. Their families have to bring, in most of those cases, a bucket of water for their daily needs. Those are the reports. And I would like your comments on how do you think those are lives. And Professor Klepak, what do you think of thousands and thousands of military men being in prison for many years since the start of the revolution, and that in 1989 and 1990, we saw the execution of the most popular general in the army, Arnaldo Ochoa, and who had wide international reputation, and the rumors were that he had expressed curiosity for perestroika and glasnost. And these are the drugs. It's not, I think, accepted by the Cuban people, unless by the army, at least by the army. I think that the army has not yet become reconciled to the idea of General Ochoa being executed. And as to the rest, your presentation was brilliant. Aside, I would say it was in many senses romantic and lyric. And in that sense, my compliments.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for your question. I agree entirely that the Cuban healthcare system has deteriorated during the special period. Even though there have been very strong attempts to maintain certain standards. And one of the key problems, of course, is there are so many doctors and health personnel abroad that it's creating a lot of problems, and a lot of those that are not sufficiently trained are now sort of taking part in healthcare. And really this has resulted in an enormous amount of problems, and the government is also talking about the renovation of the hospital system. So there has unquestionably been a decline in healthcare, and the population are very aware of this and complain about it quite bitterly. But I would point out to you that in comparison to the Soviet Union, where life expectancy since 1990 has fallen from 68 to 62, which is on a level now with Pakistan, that life expectancy in Cuba has risen from 74 to 78. So despite the fact that the system has deteriorated, the Cubans must be doing something right. But I do believe that, you know, I will repeat, I think that the external kind of forays of Cuba, the provision of healthcare on an enormous scale, or healthcare support, healthcare diplomacy, has certainly debilitated the system, and also the degree of corruption that exists in Cuba has also not helped.
Yes, the regalito has become something of a rule, and although it's usually on the family basis, the little gift for the doctor, it is almost generalized. On the other hand, the medical care has improved enormously, partially as a result of armed forces involvement in support of the civilian community. Of course, the treatment of Batista's army especially is particularly disappointing because, of course, Fidel's public stance from the Sierra Maestra was that it's not your fault. We know that you're in the service of a savage dictatorship. We know that the army is not really a bad institution. It's just being corrupted by these very senior officers. And then, of course, the treatment meted out to much more than just senior officers is really quite severe indeed. It's certainly disappointing, to say the least, that those decisions were taken at that time. On Ochoa, of course, five Cubans, six opinions. Everybody has an Ochoa theory. I mean, if you really wanted to do well, you just traipse around collecting them. I think it's probably that we get a bit reductionist, if I can use an academic term, about it, and we want one explanation. My own view is that it was in Fidel's interest that he go because of glasnost and perestroika and also perhaps personal ambitions. It was in Raúl's interest that the Minint come more under armed forces' direct command, and eight sackings of generals, because not just the execution, eight general officers sacked, and I don't know how many colonels. People say 90, possibly senior officers. I don't know how many of those would have been colonels. A lot can be said about this remarkable moment, but it is 89-90. Cuba is a very nervous society, and the government is very nervous as well since July. It's, after all, the special period comes in the summer of 90, but Fidel's announcement that things might very badly go off track is the 26th of July, 89. So I'm not sure, and I'm not sure we'll ever know exactly what the ramifications are, but it did divide the army. One of the advantages for Minint was that since a purge followed the execution, many of the people who were most annoyed were gone, so that the institution not only became under much more military command, but the institution itself had purged itself of many of the people who might have caused difficulties. So my suspicion is it didn't have as much impact on the ground institutionally. Lots of debate, but I don't think it affected the military's loyalty overall to the revolution, or belief that of the options out there, the continuation of support of the current system was the right one. And I think even less so as time has gone on, because now, 20 years on, it's very much a historical issue in Cuba rather than a current one.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, let's thank our distinguished panelists for their presentation.